We're doing it. Chazonish, Emuna u'Bitachon. We're up to page Lametet. Yesh od ra'a chola asher ha'yetzer yelafet ba la'ani emunat chachamim milev bnei adam v'umishkal ha'mirma shel ha'negiyah.
There's another illness that can sometimes envelop a person and cause him to distrust chachamim, and that is that deceitful tendency of partiality, where a person is partial. We are very affected by what we study or what we believe, and so that partiality will distort our vision, and we don't always recognize it. Chovat ha-talmid la'amin ki en negia ba'olam ba'alat koach la'atot lev chacham la'avet mishpat. If you want to study Torah, you have to believe that the one who's teaching you is going to be honest, and not necessarily the one teaching specifically sitting here in this seat, but the Torah that you're studying is being given over in tradition from people who are honest, and their partiality will not shift their heart to say something that's not true. So when you study, if you're not confident in that, then you have a big problem. Then you say, wait a second, so maybe they were giving me their own agenda. And then the agenda could change with generations, right? The only reason I can accept something I'm studying from the oral tradition is if I believe that what I'm being given is completely true. And I believe that the people are doing their best to be truthful. That, says the Chazon Ish, is a core element in order to be able to learn. I'm studying Talmud. I remember when I was a kid. I used to think, who says Rashi's right? And maybe Rashi didn't think of my answer. Maybe I have a better answer. It took a number of years till I matured enough to appreciate how much smarter than me Rashi is. It took another number of years till I realized Rashi was a genius. When I opened as I was learning Tanakh, there's one pasuk in Tanakh where Rashi mentions, he says, by the way, I'm not so sure why this pasuk is not listed. There is a medrash that lists the few psukim in Tanakh that have every letter of the Hebrew alphabet in that pasuk. So there's a medrash that says, here's a listing of those psukim. So Rashi, on one pasuk in Tanakh, says, I don't know why this pasuk doesn't appear in the list. Now I ask you, how many, is there half, I don't know how many psukim there are in Tanakh. I never counted. But how many psukim are there in Torah, it says, in the end of the Chumash? You guys know? I don't know. I don't know. You got to figure the average chapter.
It's like a little bit, like 5,000.
No, much more than that. In Tanakh, psukim, not prakim.
I'm just talking about
not chapters. Not chapters, I could tell you, there are about 700 chapters. Let's say the average the average chapter, let's say, has somewhere in the range of 25 verses, okay? So let's do 700 times 25. No, how much is that? All our mathematicians here? That's what?
17,500.
Oh, about 17,000, right? So we have about 17,000 psukim in Tanakh. I don't think Rashi went one by one and checked if they have the whole Hebrew alphabet. But when Rashi read a pasuk, he noticed, hey, this pasuk has all the Hebrew alphabet. I don't notice till today, and even after I saw that Rashi, I couldn't tell you if any pasuk has all the Hebrew alphabet because I never paid attention to it. Mm-hmm. But Rashi, in his commentary, says, by the way, I don't know why this pasuk isn't listed there. So as you study Rashi a little bit, you start understanding, wow, okay, he is very, very smart. And when you read Rashi's responsa, then you start realizing Rashi refers to what he wrote in his commentary on Shas, and you see how exacting Rashi was, because in his responsa he refers back to what he wrote, and you see he says, you know, I used this word and not that word, and I gave this interpretation, not that interpretation. You start saying, oh, wait a second, he did really think this through completely. But when I was younger, I didn't have that respect. I wasn't smart enough to have that respect. So Chazon Ish says, you want to be able to learn, you have to have that respect. You have to believe that nothing in the world would affect those who give over tradition from to veer from the truth. Ki magamata chacham nizakot nafsho. The goal of a chacham is to purify their own soul. Velihitgael be'eze ashma, and to filthy himself with anything that's less than completely honest, yichav lenafsho yoter mikol makav ve'petza, should pain his soul more than any wound. because I'm trying to be a good person, an honest person. So then the worst thing is if I'm not. V'ech yitachem ki b'shvil betza kesef? How could it be that for money? Or le'agei chanaf? Or because I want to sweet talk someone? Yechaven nafsho lavet mishpat? He would hurt his own soul and do something that's dishonest? The Chazon Ish is talking about where a person should be if they're teaching Torah. Nosaf leze ki tchunat ha'emet yetzel chacham tchunato tchunat nafsho v'shosh mitziyuta. Add to that that the trait of truth should be a trait of the soul, part of the root of one's existence when he's learned Torah. V'chol avkat sheker mimenu v'hala. And a dust, the slightest dust of a lie, meaning he means the smallest particle of a lie, should be most distant from him. V'cheni emunat amon yesharim amitabkim ba'afar aglei chachamim. And those who cling to a teacher, that's because they believe he is telling the truth. That's Aleph Beis. If you believe he is honest and truthful, you could learn him. You don't believe it, so then who said what he's teaching is true? You know, Achayetzer chatar chatira tachat kisei ha'neman letzodid nafshot hanotot lehitchakmut ומביא להם לימוד שלם מן הגמרא, כי הנגיעה היא בעלת כוח, מכריע לקטנים ולגדולים יחד. But when a person wants to learn, so he starts having second thoughts, and he says, maybe no. Maybe they're also partial, and you know what? I could even show you from the Gemara, a person can think to himself, that a person will always be affected by a bribe, or a person will always be partial. לפניה יחרו גם הנבונים ביותר, and even the wisest of men bow before a good bribe. גם חסידים ואנשי מעשה, even pious people. ואין זה גנאי לחכמים אחרי שכן הוחק בטבע אנושי. And you tell yourself, well, we're all human, so we could all be affected by bribes. You know, it's interesting. Someone called with a shayla. They asked a question in the laws of Lashon Hara. Their question was if they're allowed to tell over something about someone who is very abusive. And I thought about it for about 2-3 minutes. And then I said, I can't answer you. I need you to ask someone else. So they said, why can't you answer me? And I said, because I feel that I cannot be impartial enough to think about this question honestly. I'm so upset because I know the abuse this person did that I'm not capable right now of taking that out of my mind and thinking honestly and rationally, what does the halacha say in this instance? Can you tell over the story or not? I see, as much as I'm trying to think clearly and answer you halachically, I'm not succeeding. You have to ask someone else. So part of our attempts to be honest is to realize when it's beyond our capacity. Sometimes a person says, I can't. I'm not impartial. You know, we once had a store we were trying to sell. It wasn't too successful, to put it mildly. And when I spoke to a friend of mine who was considering buying it, so the first thing I said to him was, let's put the cards on the table. My interest is that you buy this store. So you're going to ask me some questions about the store, and I'm going to try to be honest with you. But as much as I'm going to try to be honest, I know I might veer to the right and describe the store too well, but I might also veer to the left and be too earnest in my attempts to tell you why it's not a worthwhile proposition. Obviously, we want to get rid of it, so you have to figure out. I'll try to be honest and give you the facts, but because I'm partial, because I'm not impartial, I have an interest. So you have to figure out where the truth lies. I will try to be truthful. I'm not sure I'll succeed. Because either way, if you veer to the right or the left, that's not the truth. If you say it's too bad, worse than it really is, that's not the truth. And if you say it's better than it really is, that's not the truth either. There is a truth. The question is, can you get it? Well, part of our attempts to be honest is to be able to say when we're not there, when we know I'm not capable. You know, you'll ask a person about their own child, so they're partial. So a person should at least say they're partial. That's why the Torah says, you can't sit on a court, you can't judge your own child. You're partial. You should be. It's your kid. So a person tells himself, well, everyone is affected. We're all partial. But what a person doesn't realize, mityatem kol ador. Then the generation has become orphaned. Then shofet ba'aretz, you could never have a judge. If you're going to say everyone's partial, no one's honest, then there's no leadership, then there's no judge. V'nitpatla sanedria shel aretz, you could never have a court. Because then no one will agree to listen to a judge. We'll all agree he's smart. We'll all agree he's a good person. But why should I listen to him? In my case, he is dishonest. And you'll always say, you know why he said that? That's because of, and you'll find something to point at, and you'll say, you see, he's not being honest. Now, what happens when you come for a halachic ruling? What happens when most people go to court? You know what happens? I once heard this. I don't know if I'm allowed to say from who, but it's a well-known rabbi that I think all of you have heard of and respect. And he once said to us in a class, he said, what happens almost always in a court case is that both parties walk out upset. Because when you take your friend or your neighbor to court, you're 100% convinced that he's 100% wrong, and he's 100% convinced that you're 100% wrong. And the courts will come out and say, okay, this fellow's 65% right, and this fellow's 35% right. So they both walk away upset. They both walk away saying, what do they know? So what? So the rabbis ruled. What do they know? I'm 100% right. And everyone's upset that they didn't get their way completely. When a court tries to do what's right and be honest and be impartial, that does not guarantee that people will view them that way. So that's why we have a generation that looks down at its judges and judges them. And every person does whatever they think is right, because why should I listen to him? He's only talking out of his own partiality. In any instance that arises, people start whispering and outsmarting and saying, oh, the rabbi said this, but what does he know? He's talking because he's partial. ולפעמים המובהק שבדו, בעמדתו הבלתי נכונה, וכל אווירה של העיר, ולפעמים אווירה של כל הארץ, מתמלאת שוט ולשון. Sometimes, a person can be the leader of the generation, and he gives a ruling which people don't like. And suddenly, everyone's talking, and you could have a whole city talking, and you could have the whole country talking, and everyone's talking, tatotim rivot, fighting this way and that way, v'lelo emuna b'chachamim gavu ba'aretz. And the source of it all is that they've lost faith. They're not willing to trust the one who's supposed to represent the Torah. Now, this is a common thing. That's what we're about to see forward. I don't know what you guys are thinking. But I suspect that many of you are thinking about current events. No? That what's going on in everyone's mind?
I'm thinking too personal. I'm thinking about what's called the life. And I have an opinion that if there's, if something wrong has been done, and it's under the standard of moral views, I think the rabbi, even if it doesn't help, going to help, just to show the others, this is not the way to do it, just come to the state.
Right, but like we just said, everyone's partial.
But if you don't say something, when something happens, rabbis are not saying their opinion enough to them.
Okay, so I...
people can listen, but if it's not being said...
So let's try to analyze this on a broader scale. Every few years, and we've had this throughout Jewish history, there have been people who were fakers. Every few years, there were people who made it up the ranks. When I was in yeshiva, they caught someone who broke into hundreds, if not thousands, of offices in Jerusalem on Shabbos and Yom Kippur, and he was a student of rabbinics. So now what are you going to say? Look at what the rabbis are like, breaking into stores on Yom Kippur. Obviously not. The guy was trying to fool everyone, and he was taking a course in the middle of getting tested to get a rabbinical license, and he was smart enough to con everyone into thinking he was a good person, when in fact he was a thief. I was one of the people he robbed. He stole me too. He robbed a lot of people. When they came to his house, so I'm saying, if we look at Jewish history, what we see is that in Moshe's time, there was a man named Korah. He had a long white beard, and he had a very respectable job. He was one of the holiest people. He carried the ark on his shoulder. You didn't get to that position if you weren't someone very important. Very important, I mean, as far as piety and learning and observing Torah and mitzvot. So Korach made it to the top ranks, and suddenly it was discovered something went wrong. With Korach, it seems that until the point that he went sour, he was good, because otherwise he wouldn't have lasted that long. There were Levites who were dropping dead because they weren't worthy of standing so close to the Aron. That's why the tribe of Levite never became so great in numbers, because they died. If you were next to the Aron and you weren't worthy, then there was no second chance. And Korach did not drop dead. He carried the Aron and he lived to tell the tale until he didn't. So that certainly seems an indicator that he went bad. And we have in Jewish history, numerous instances where people just went sour. They were positive people, and then they fell. Then you have people who fell and got back on their feet again. That's another story. That's what we were learning about in the earlier class. You look at Reuven, and you see at the end, Reuven made it to be one of the tribes. Did Reuven sin with Bilhah or not sin with Bilhah? So we had learned the opinion that he did not do things as atrocious as the Pasuk describes. We did not yet learn, the Gemara in a few lines will quote opinions that say that no, he did do what it says in the verse. You know, there are opinions in the Talmud that say take the verse literally. We didn't get there yet. We were in the middle, we got cut off in the middle. But if you look at Jewish history, you see that you had a prophet Elisha and his top student who ran the Beit Midrash, who was considered a very dignified rabbi to the point where Elisha sent him to resurrect the dead. So he was considered a pretty big person, this Gehazi, and yet, all along, from the beginning, Gehazi was dishonest, unscrupulous. He did not adhere to his teacher's teachings, but his teacher didn't know that. Other people knew that. His teacher didn't know that. And he was able to con people. And this is a recurring theme in our history. It's complicated, because here we're reading about trusting, and yet you say, wait a second, but you can't always trust. And that's true. There's a certain balance, and you also have to... There are 2 points here. One is, if things seem wrong, then ask a question. You know, you're supposed to ask. You're supposed to question. You're supposed to verify. You could take it to other people and say, wait, is what this person is doing right or wrong? Is this proper behavior? Is it improper behavior? A person isn't supposed to trust blindly. And trust is something that's acquired over time. You ask questions, you verify, you start understanding, and even then, at every moment, every human being has the b'chira chofshit. You still have free choice. You could become super pious, super learned, and decide the wrong decision one day. You know, not just because a person's made the right decision for 65 years doesn't mean that now he's going to make the right decision. He still has free will. We had a high priest, we had a Kohen Gadol who went into the Holy of Holies year after year and lived to tell the tales. He was pretty pious, and yet in the end he turned sour. He turned against his own tradition. It's reported, I wasn't around back then, but there was a man named Shabtai Tzvi, and according to the legends, big rabbis came to test him, and he knew halacha backward and forward. They couldn't catch him on a detail he didn't know. He was a super genius. And then he became an apostate. It became clear that he was a charlatan. But, you see, he was able to go up the ranks in knowledge of Torah and convince people, and even convince people to change customs. And it took time until people figured out, hey, this guy's a liar, this guy's a fake. And he knew a lot of Torah. So, we're reading about trust. Without trust, you can't grow. The flip side is, everyone's thinking, wait, we just saw, it's just become pretty public that someone who people trusted was not worthy of that trust. Okay, trust does not mean that you don't verify. You know, what happened there shouldn't have happened. And, you know, people should have asked. We do have a responsibility to question. Trust does not mean you don't question. On the contrary, you should question. Yes.
I agree with you on that. I think on a level of just analyzing current events, it's also not helpful on a level of when the Fatih Dinin are against each other. In the States, the Fatih Dinin are against each other. In California specifically, I'm aware of
I don't know what's going on in Los Angeles
where there was a court case and all the Fatih Dinin were against each other. And it got very messy, and they had to go to New York about it and stuff like that. And people hear about this, and I'm a nobody, and I know about this. So obviously, if one nobody knows about it, many nobodies know.
I don't know what you're talking about. I honestly, I don't know.
I don't want to go into the plot team because it takes away from the thing, but it was just there were multiple Batidunim that all kind of ruled against each other on this case, and it had to go to like very, very big rabbis in New York. But then people hear about these things. Or to maybe give a more local example, the stuff that happens in B'nai B'rach, when you read some yeshiva news websites, there's fights between this rabbi students and this rabbi students, because this rabbi made this ruling and that rabbi made that ruling. They fight it, and it doesn't help so much with people trusting rabbis, because they say, look, this guy, his students, he's getting his students to go charging after this other rabbi and to beat him up and things like this.
I don't know. I'm saying I think that historically we've had an issue with students. It's true. There were Hasidim who did things that were very wrong against Misnagdim, and there were Misnagdim who did things that were very wrong against Hasidim. I don't think the Gra ever told his students to go and break glass in a Hasid's mikvah. And I don't think the Baal Shem Tov ever told his students to go and put nails in the Misnagdim's mikvah. I don't think they ever did that. But the students were very zealous and they in the wrong direction, and terrible things happened. There are plenty of stories. I think we have to delineate. There are fakers. There are people who are not worthy of a post, a position, a title, and we have to be wary of them. And then there are people who are students, or at least they get that title, and they're not really listening to their teacher. I can tell you even there were instances where things were publicized in the names of big rabbis. And I went and I asked the rabbi, and I said, there was an instance here in Kiryat Moshe where they published that the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz Harav said to vote for a certain party. Blew my mind. That party had done things that were pretty unacceptable. And I asked him, and he said, I didn't say that. They published that and they didn't ask me. It's just not true. And then they published things in the name of a certain rabbi in Bnei Brak that's very well known, that he promised to donate to this, you'll get that. And I went and I asked, did you say that? And his sons-in-law, I didn't get into him, they said no, he never said that. He doesn't even know that they published it in his name. He doesn't know. And I said, well, don't you think you have to make him aware? And they told me they're trying, but they, you know, you sometimes have to question, is it better to make the fight when you won't necessarily win the fight? It's a tough call. I've seen numerous instances where things were said in people's names, and it's very far from it. Rabbi Feinstein once said that the Mishnah in the end of Kachim says, how many sounds does an animal make? So the Mishnah says it makes this number of sounds when it's alive, and then it makes so many more sounds when it's dead, because when it's dead, you could take its horns and make one sound with it, and you could take the hide, and you can make a drum out of it, and you could take the intestines, and you can make a harp out of it. And the Mishnah works out how many more sounds it can make when it's dead. And so Rabbi Feinstein said, that's the way it is with a big rabbi too. When he's alive, so you hear three versions of what he said, or five versions of what, and when he's dead, so then there are many, many more versions of what he said.
I was in Lubavitch Yeshiva, and being Baal Shuva, they feed you one thing, and then you hear from this group, another thing, and this group.
It's very hard.
What do you mean?
But sometimes it's well-intending people. I can guarantee you that after our conversation tonight, if you guys will walk in the hallway and compare notes, okay, what was said, you will have heard different things.
Yeah.
Because when we listen to something, so we we automatically catch on to certain sentences, certain phrases, and we give them our own interpretations, which is a human, it's a human condition. That's the way we are. So it's not always stemming from bad intent. It's part of how we clear things up. That's why the Talmud says you want a tradition, you have to spend many years learning by a teacher, because you don't necessarily understand the first time you hear something. You digest it, you come back and say it and question it, and then you digest it again, you question it again. And after you've reviewed it numerous times, you start having clarity. Our issue for the past millennium has been that students don't stick around for 40 years. People think they know everything long before that. I always joke that I'm the worst student because I'm still studying, I'm still learning. The rabbi who gave me smicha, I stayed and learned by him as long as I could. And there's another rabbi who, till today, I go and I pose as many questions as I can, because there's always what to learn. Yeah, and there are people who know more than me, and there are people who have better tradition than me. And so you keep learning and clarifying. But you gotta if you want clarity, it takes a lot of time. And otherwise things can get confused. So it's not always stemming from bad intentions. Sometimes it's stemming from miscommunication. When the machine matzah came out, so there was a man with an agenda. Initially, the rabbis who saw the machine matzah approved it. And then there was a person who had an agenda, and he went to numerous rabbis, and he started describing the machine matzah inaccurately. And the rabbis trusted him because he knew, he was able to describe what the machine was. And then rabbis came out with rulings that it's prohibited to eat machine matzahs. And then you had a situation where courts throughout Europe were fighting with one another because you had whole communities in Germany and other communities that were eating machine matzahs, and their rabbis ruled it was perfectly kosher. And you had other communities where they never saw machine matzah. They were going based on the testimony of one person, and they thought he was a trustworthy person based on that. It didn't dawn on them that someone was leading them on. They took that information and, seeing diagrams, getting a description, they gave a ruling based on what they thought was an accurate understanding, and they went out against it. And all of Europe for a number of years was set ablaze. You had courts fighting with one another and writing very sharp letters to the point where people, you had advertisements in certain communities, even if your in-laws live in that community, don't go and eat their machine matzah because there's no way to permit eating such a thing. That was based on what they were told. They were told that the machine heats up. They were told many things about how the matzah was produced that were just not true. Someone had an agenda and they found a way to convince the rabbis, and the rabbis didn't yet see the machine. When you suddenly had open discourse and they were able to actually see it and not just write letters back and forth, they suddenly realized, okay, we don't disagree. This is a different... But it took time. It took time to understand where the discord came in. So the fact that you have quarreling Batei Din can sometimes be because someone has an agenda and they're going to mislead one of the Batei Din, and they're not always going to be on top of it so fast. Sometimes it takes time. Sometimes it takes communication. What?
I've heard the same with regards to electricity. Some guys have one kind of light, some guys have another kind of light.
Okay, I'm saying...
The accepted ruling today is that it's malacha, but...
Right.
I've seen shulot written with different, with non... the one that ignites...
the Aruch HaShulchan...
And now the diodes and other
things. The Aruch HaShulchan writes about a microscope. He says he was told, and you could read this in the Aruch HaShulchan, he was told that if you look in a microscope, you can see little people. So that's what he was told. Because someone described him inaccurately what you see with a microscope. Where he lived, he didn't see a microscope. The Chafetz Chaim was asked to rule on a shaver, on an electric shaver. And he gave one ruling, and then they came and showed him an electric shaver, and he gave another ruling. Sometimes you don't have the facts in front of you. Sometimes people bring you a description or a diagram. They describe it one way, and you give a ruling. We had here in Israel about 20 years ago, one of the very respected science and halacha institutes gave a ruling about electric shavers. And their ruling stemmed from the best understanding they could attain about a shaver. They were told that the way a shaver works is that the hair goes through the screen, and the screen protects your skin from being cut by the blade, and then the blade cuts the hair. That's what they were told. What they weren't told, which they didn't know at the time, was that the blade actually only cuts the hair because the screen holds the hair in place. So all the experiments they did, they removed the screen because they needed to take micro cameras and analyze the hair being cut by the blade to see if it's considered shaving with a razor or not. They removed the screen, applied their cameras, watched the blade hit the hairs, and saw that the blade was not sharp enough to cut the hair without the screen. And then they said, you see, it's a scissor effect. It's not cutting from the sharpness of the blade, it's cutting from a scissor effect of the blade against the screen. Then, after about a decade, after they gave that ruling, Norelco, Philips, came out with little cameras that they were able to inject into their shavers, and they took a picture of how the blade actually cuts when the screen is in place, when someone's taking a shave. And when they saw that, they realized that the sharpness of the blade does cut the hair. It's just, and it's not a scissor effect, but you need the screen to hold the hair in place. Even Norelco had thought that the screen's main function was to protect the skin and to provide a scissor effect. But then they realized that's not what's happening. It's never hitting the edge of the screen. The blade is cutting it before it hits the screen. So you don't have a scissor effect. It's not that you have, let's say, the screen, the hair coming down here, and the blade cuts it against the screen, but rather long before it hits the screen and that gap where the hair came in, so long as the hair is held in place, the blade cuts it. Suddenly, the facts changed on us. So sometimes we do the best we can, and then we discover we made a mistake. It's not always with malicious intent or because people have it in for one another. The flip side is that you do have in the Talmud a concept of betin shel hedyotot, that sometimes simple people decide to convene a court. The Talmud says in the days of King Solomon, the high court said, no accepting converts. And then a lot of people decided, we know better, and established their own courts and accepted converts. And you had 150,000 people converted by private courts, where people decided that even though King Solomon and the high court ruled that we're not accepting converts, you had courts that people convened. They were good kosher Jews, and they said, hey, in Allah it says you can convert, and if someone wants to convert, we're going to accept them. And they established courts that are called in the Talmud, Betin Shel Hedyotot. Simple people put together a court. Legally, the people were Jewish. They were converted by a Jewish court.
That means they're not trained enough.
So it's a little tricky. That's why it's important to try and find a teacher who we can trust, who we can work with. And even when you trust the person, it's important to question. Keep your wits about you and ask. And if something looks strange, you ask. You know, probably the main teacher I had was Rav Pesin Zatzal. And he gave me hours every week of his time. After each class, I'd ask him questions for hours. And at one point, there was a case that came to his court, and he ruled on the case against an organization that was helping the poor, that was feeding the poor. And in his court, he ruled against it, not in their favor. And I happened to volunteer in that organization, and I knew their side of the story. And when I heard his ruling, I stopped going to his classes for about a month, because I was young, and I was sure I knew everything, or at least almost everything, right? And when I heard his ruling, I couldn't justify it. So even though I had learned so much by him, and he gave me so much of his time, and I said, I don't see this as being ethical. So I made the mistake the Chazon Ish talks about here. I was sure that something's wrong there. I didn't think maybe I'm missing something. I thought he was missing something. So I stopped going to the class, and after about a month, I had confronted him beforehand, and he didn't go into the details. He just basically said, this is what's right, and that's what I ruled. I'm not changing it. I'll tell you what the story was, because it's actually a very interesting story. We had organizations in that town where people, organizations that did charity. And the court came and said, the local court said, you have to have rabbinic oversight to your organizations. And this organization said, who are you? What are you, why are you telling us we need rabbinic oversight? We've been feeding the poor, helping the poor for years now, before you guys ever had a court, and now you're going to tell us we need rabbinic oversight? No. So the rabbis pressured them, and they said no, and there was a power, a fight of wills. And finally, the rabbis said, look, you're asking us to fundraise for you now. We're not fundraising. We're telling our community members to stop donating. So here I am, and I see the food we're giving to the poor, and I came to him, and I said, how could you do that? People are going to go hungry this Shabbos. What? How could you tell people not to donate to the organization? And he said, because that's what's right. And I couldn't understand it. And fine, I stopped going to his classes for I don't know how many weeks. Only later, about 2 or 3 years later, when scandals started hitting the press, when it became clear that there were certain organizations that were embezzling funds, did I realize what he had understood 3 years earlier. He knew that I'm looking at the here and now. There are poor people hungry. He's looking at the global picture. If you have an organization and no one's overseeing to ensure that there isn't embezzlement, then the fact that you see products that are good doesn't tell you that behind the scenes there aren't problems. And he obviously understood that there were things going on, not necessarily with this organization, but they came to all the organizations of the community and said, every organization has to have real oversight. And the organization I was volunteering in said, no, why should we listen to you? And they said to them, you choose the rabbi. We're not telling you who to choose, so long as it's someone who's responsible and honest, who will make sure that there's no hanky-panky going on with the money. And the organization said, who are you to come and tell us what's going on? We're feeding the poor. Okay, they knew what they were doing. I didn't understand what they were doing. I only saw a fact. There are poor people, we need to feed them. He, from his perspective, saw, if you're not going to ensure that what's happening is honest and correct, then you might not have an organization in 2 years, and you'll have poor people who will have nowhere to turn. Okay, I'm just giving an example. I'm saying, and from my vantage point, he was dead wrong. And when I thought he was dead wrong, I had a hard time learning Torah from him. I couldn't. Okay, so it's difficult. It's difficult. We have to question. We're not always going to be able to hear all the answers. A person's not always privileged to tell you everything that's going on. He couldn't tell me, look, you don't know what's going on. He couldn't start filling me in on details that were none of my business. And yet, from my vantage point, I didn't understand them. It's a tough balancing act. But coming back to the Chazon Ish, if you don't have this, you don't have anything. If you don't feel you can trust the person, so then every ruling they're going to give and every answer they're going to give is questionable. This is complicated. I would add a few more points here that are important for our general knowledge living as observant people. If someone asks the rabbi a question, he asks the rabbi, let's say, let's take example number one. A pregnant woman calls up and asks, do I have to fast on Tisha B'Av? So let's say in her case, she calls me up and I say, no, you don't have to fast on Tisha B'Av. So what's going to happen next year, her sister's going to be pregnant and she's going to tell her sister, I called the rabbi last year and he told me that pregnant women don't have to fast on Tisha B'Av. Now, what she doesn't realize is that maybe she has hypoglycemia, maybe she has low iron, maybe this year Tisha B'Av falls out on Shabbos, and so it's derailed to Sunday, and that gives it different legal standing, and we're more lenient on a Tisha B'Av that's pushed from Shabbos to Sunday. So when she asked the question and I gave the answer, she thinks she understood the answer. Well, she understood what's relevant to her. That doesn't mean she understood what she can quote to the next guy. One of the mistakes we sometimes make in halacha is that we assume that halacha is one size fits all, and it's not that way. Halacha takes into account many, many, many factors. You know, one person called me up and said, can I buy a new shirt this week? And I said, no, you're not allowed to buy new clothing in the 9 days. As Ashkenazim, we don't buy new clothing in the 9 days. Another person called up and said, can I buy a new shirt this week? And the answer was yes, because in their circumstance, they were talking about buying for a child, and the child has a certain skin condition where the child would be pained if they didn't have enough shirts. Okay, the halacha doesn't say a child has to be in pain at the expense of not buying a shirt this week. There's a, you know, but people think, you know, I asked the question, I got the answer, now I can quote it to other people. If you hear a question that was asked from a rabbi and the rabbi gave the halachic ruling, all you know is that in their instance, that was the ruling. You have a question, verify the halacha for your case. People make this mistake all the time. They quote to one another what the rabbi said, and that's how mistakes spread. And then sometimes we have another issue. I'll get to you guys in 1 second. Sometimes people say, I called the rabbi and he told me I don't have to fast. And he called the rabbi and he said he does have to fast. I guess I called on a good day. He called when the rabbi was having a bad day. Yeah, he was annoyed, so he answered him that way. That's like, come on, give us a little bit of credit. We're trying to be honest and say the truth. Sometimes there are factors which you don't see from your end, but we have to see. Yes?
Is it about buying new clothes or marrying new clothes?
Both. We don't purchase new clothes, Ashkenazim. In the 9 days, Ashkenazim don't purchase new clothes, nor do they wear new clothing. Yes. Just by the way, it's legitimate to ask a rabbi what the source for what he's saying is. That's also legitimate. Sometimes a rabbi will say, it's too complicated, I can't give you all the sources. And sometimes he can, but it's legitimate to ask. Yes.
Okay. It's one thing for me to ask a shayla, but it's another thing for me to tell someone else what to do because I'm not a rabbi. So people that aren't rabbis shouldn't repeat things that a rabbi said because they're quote unquote they're trying to tell someone halacha.
Right. When I was being interviewed in Kochav Yaakov, so one of the things I told them was that for the first 2 years, I would be very limited in the halachic rulings I could give, because halacha is personal. Until you understand the people you're talking to, it's hard to know the answer to give them. I'll tell you one mistake I made in halachic ruling in Kochav Yaakov. A couple called me up and asked if they're allowed to rely on a certain leniency on Pesach and eat certain foods on Pesach. So I tried to understand why they were asking the question, and they didn't give me a clear answer. And after talking to them for about 5 minutes, I said, look, from what I understand from you, it's a question of convenience. Well, our custom is that we don't do that leniency on Pesach, and I know it would be more convenient to go with that leniency, but you'll have to make do with other foods. Don't go with that leniency. Okay, I had the good fortune of, I don't remember why, landing in their house in the middle of a meal on Pesach. I don't remember. Maybe I came to bring them something, they forgot in shul or something. I don't remember why I ended up knocking on their door. They open the door, and I see them sitting for the meal, and I see that they have no food at the table. When they asked the question, they didn't express to me how this ruling would affect their lives. As much as I asked them, and I tried to understand why the leniency was important to them, they didn't give me a clear picture, or I didn't catch what they were saying well enough. And when I came to their table and I suddenly saw they're in the middle of the meal, and the meal consists of matzah and a potato, I suddenly understood that why that leniency was important to them. So part of the challenge is, our challenge is to understand the question correctly. Your challenge is to present the question correctly. And very often I'll ask a person, why are you asking the question? And I'm trying to understand, why is this important to you? And a person's job is to explain it, because that also has halachic relevance. So I'm just saying there's a lot that goes into giving a halachic ruling, and sometimes the rabbi's ruling can seem weird or wrong. Ask. And sometimes you can present one more detail and it makes all the difference. You know, a person called up and said, does my wife have to fast on Yom Kippur? And I asked, why shouldn't she fast on Yom Kippur? And he says, well, she gave birth a month ago. And I said, how's she feeling? She feels fine. And the guy doesn't give me all the details until I question him for 5 minutes, and it turns out she had an operation and she hasn't yet recovered from the operation. It's a totally different question. You know, when you call up and you say, my wife gave birth a month ago, well, most people after a month, and she sounds like she feels fine, but you forgot to mention that she lost a lot of blood and she only got out of the hospital 2 days ago. And, okay, that makes a little bit of a difference, right? That's a different question. People sometimes forget the details that change the question. And that's why it's important. If the ruling seems off, ask the question. Ask another question. You know, maybe the person didn't understand your question right. So we're in the middle. We'll have to get back to this.